I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Jaime Cascio. Jaime is co-founder of the website worldchanging.com. He is an author of several books, science fiction novels, transhuman space novels, Broken Dreams, and Toxic Memes, and now runs a futurist consulting firm, Open the Future. Jaime is also a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and one of the folks who writes frequently for us. He has a very productive writing career. I really appreciate how much you produce, how many thoughts you generate. One of the pieces that you wrote last year that I really liked was about the ethics of futurists and the kinds of things that futurists needed to keep in mind when they approached their task. Could you talk a little bit about the biases that you see in futurism? You mentioned things like, you know, avoiding hype and dead-end trends and gadgetry. One of the problems with a lot of futurism is that they have a very linear approach to their extrapolation, and you've been coming out of the thinking about post-humanity in a serious way and some of the revolutionary potentials of technology. You see this linearity, like, you know, when the U.S. Census Bureau projects what the population is going to be like in 2080. You know, I know that you think that that's basically nonsense. So how do we overcome that kind of linearity, and how do we avoid falling off the other side, which is to say, well, it's all going to be the singularity, so you can't talk past 2020.
Right. Well, it's a hard problem because we are accustomed, in many ways we have evolved to think in linear ways about the future. Our brains developed very good tools for making quick and reasonably accurate projections of the immediate moment into the very near term. Whether you think about it, something as simple as catching a ball. That's a remarkably complex task because you have to figure out where the ball is going to be. And so the mechanisms, the neurological mechanisms that went into the development of these kinds of capabilities really give us fairly decent tools for thinking in that linear way about what's coming. The problem is, when you look out more than just, realistically the next few minutes, things don't remain linear. And with the advent of some pretty remarkable technologies that we've already seen and the new ones that are coming down the road, it makes it all that much more difficult to make reasonable projections. I think the solution, such as it is, comes from not thinking about a single future. The future isn't written in stone. We really can't predict precisely what happens. So we're much better off thinking in terms of scenarios, thinking in terms of different possibilities. The Futures Study Department at the University of Hawaii at Manoa actually has a mandate that you never talk about the future in the singular. You always talk about it as futures. And I think that's actually a pretty useful way of thinking about it, because you never want to say, this is what will happen. What you want to say is, this is what could happen, and this other thing is what could happen. And so the more scenarios you build out, the more different perspectives you develop on what the future could hold, the more likely it is that what will emerge is something that will map relatively well to what actually does come out. At the very least, we'll give the people who read and engage with these future scenarios a better opportunity to arm themselves, to prepare themselves for what's coming down the road.
I recently participated with a couple folks that we know, Nick Bostrom and some others, in a futurist consulting project for a proprietary consulting firm. Mm-hmm. And we were supposed to be extrapolating what the global health scenario would be in 2030. And I refused on those grounds that you just mentioned to give a scenario. I said, here's the 10 drivers of that I think are going to determine what global health will be. And if you put the settings all to the bad end, you get this horrific future. And if you put them all to the good end, you get this wonderful future. So I gave him two scenarios.
That's better than one.
Yeah, it's better than one. But yes, I think that is a huge problem. And many of our, many of the people on the techno-utopian side seem to have the similar problem that they, both on the techno-apocalypse and the techno-utopian, they don't countenance the notion that there's an openness. Is that what led you to describe your current research consulting operation and philosophy as Open the Future, to have this notion of openness to the future?
Yes, I mean, that's certainly one element of it. I really, I fully embrace the idea that the more we recognize that the future has yet to be written, the better we will be at realizing that we have in our hands the ability to write that future. And one of the things that I've encountered over and over again in the over the decade working in this field is that many people have given up. Many people, whether they are individuals in small nonprofits or people working for governments and massive transnational corporations, have given up on the notion that they have any way of controlling what's coming. They've developed this very reactive, this reactive set of beliefs about what they can do, that their best case scenario is really just weathering, surviving. And so by emphasizing that open set of possibilities, it really helps to reinvigorate the notion that, in fact, an individual's actions can be meaningful. And as individuals and as a society, we can shape what happens. Now, the other end of the open the future concept actually is related to the open source concept, which says that essentially many eyes make all bugs shallow. That is, the more people you have participating on a project, the more likely it is you will be able to ferret out the problems and the inefficiencies and the security flaws and the like, which is why, as a general rule, open source software tends to be a bit more reliable than proprietary software. I mean, there are plenty of exceptions, but that's the general rule. And so this combination of openness as a belief in possibility and openness as a rule for, a demand for participation, I think is in many ways my optimal guideline for building a future that we'd want.
I'm speaking with.
And that's why that's become the focus of my work.
This is Change Shifter Radio, and we're speaking with Jemay Cassio today. Jemay is a futurist IET fellow and the proprietor of the OpenTheFuture.com website. You have been working a lot on ecofuturism and trying to engage with our global climate crisis. And you were inspired partly in that, I understand, by Bruce Sterling's idea of a Viridian greenness. And I don't know if you've ever used the term techno-Gaian, but that's one of the terms that we throw out occasionally. So tell us a little bit about your philosophy. I understand it that you think that there are many more modalities of advanced, appropriate technology, sustainable technology, than most eco-theorists, eco-thinkers have been want to explore.
Often use techno-Gaian. I end up using cyber green. Charlie dates me. In the underlying philosophy here, is that I like civilization, and I like the fact that we have a planet full of people, and I don't want to see either one go away. And that means both not wanting to see the planet go away, not wanting to see the planet go through tremendous, nasty changes, but also means not wanting to give up what makes civilization worth having, and not wanting to give up billions of people. Because the traditional 1970s hippie green approach to environmentalism would, if you play it out, lead to the deaths of billions of people, because the planet cannot support 6 billion plus people with a 12th century agricultural model.
Yeah, organic farming is just not going to feed everybody.
Organic farming, at least as traditionally conceived, I'm very much a proponent of the use of smart technologies that improve our efficiency of use of energy. Smart technologies that reduce the impact we have on the planet, and smart technologies that give us a way to both look further out, but also control our impact further out. That is, don't give us short-term benefits with long-term costs. I've sometimes described the problems, especially the environmental problems that we face, as being long, slow disasters. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to see an impact for 50 years or 100 years. But what it means is that the process that we're going through started long before we recognized it and will continue long after we've even started to do something about it. The one concrete example that really drives this home is with regards to global warming. Something called ocean thermal inertia will make it such that even if we were to stop emitting all greenhouse gases tomorrow, like flat out globally, no more human sources of greenhouse gases, we would still see warming. We would still see atmospheric warming for another 20 to 30 years. That's because the oceans have absorbed the heat buildup and will start and are also continuing to put out that heat. They put it out much, but oceans put it out much more slowly. Ocean temperature changes much more slowly. And so we have, we face the kind of problem that, as I talked about earlier, our brains didn't evolve to deal with. We're very good at understanding immediate cause and effect. Do one thing, the other results. We're not very good at understanding causes and effects where the two ends are separated by years or decades. And so what we need to do is to continue to develop the tools that give us, the scientific tools that give us greater insight into the processes of what's happening on the planet, and the social and cultural tools that give us a better ability to make the kind of plans that deal well with long-term changes and develop the kind of society that deals well with long-term changes. And just to flag something there, I sometimes say that for most people, technology is anything invented after you turn 13. In reality, nearly everything in our lives is technology, including cultural practices. These are tools that we have developed, we have innovated, we have invented with our minds to allow us to affect change in the world. And so when I talk about the smart use of good technologies for environmental purposes, I'm not just talking about computerized sensors and hybrid cars. I'm also talking about urban design as a technology. And I'm talking about economic models as a form of technology.
Informed democratic discourse is a technology.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially because these are not isolated technologies, of course. They're mutually reinforcing. And so informed democratic discourse is something that is extremely well supported by the explosion of social networking systems.
Right.
Based social networking systems.
When I used to be flogging eco-socialism as an idea, one of the points that was very useful was to point out the ecological disaster that had occurred in China and the former Soviet Union, because they didn't have independent citizen organizations to point out the disasters that were occurring. And they had a confluence of political and economic interests who wanted to suppress any kind of evidence of ecological disaster. And it led to this enormous ecological, a greater ecological disaster than in the democratic capitalist West.
There's a term that gets bandied about in the social networking and online activism world, and that's a second superpower. And that refers to the semi-organized mass of people around the world who have been able to come together in occasionally ad hoc and random ways to promote social and global, social and cultural, and especially political change. The power of civil society around the world is in many ways readily matches the power of even the United States. Certainly the United States of recent years, which has pretty measurably declined in power. And unlike the U.S. or China, or name your favorite big country, the power of the second superpower doesn't come primarily from the military. The key weapon for the second superpower is the camera phone and instant messaging system.
We're going to get to your thoughts about that in a second. What is your scenario for energy? Do you have any hope for fusion? Do you think we should go to the nuclear path? Is ethanol a big hoo-ha? Are you a soft energy conservationist? What are we at the peak oil? where is it all with the energy path?
Well, let's see. I do think that we're probably at or near global peak oil production, which I think a lot of people have come to misunderstand as meaning that any day now, suddenly there will be no more oil. What that means is that any day now, or maybe a few weeks ago, a few months ago, or a few months from now, we'll be at a point where we will be unable, there will be less oil in the ground in total than has already been pumped. So that could include tar sands and all the various kind of exotic and expensive ways of pulling out oil. So it's going to be peak oil will be disruptive. I don't think it's going to be quite the apocalypse that people like James Howard Kunstler think it's going to be. Nuclear is an interesting question. Stuart Brand, who's in many respects the godfather of technogaianism, founder of the Whole Earth Movement, I worked with him at Global Business Network for years, and he's still someone that I encounter on a regular basis. Stuart Brand had become quite a proponent of traditional nuclear power. And I can see his argument. I mean, he says that the very worst thing that is happening to us right now is the rapid accumulation of anthropogenic carbon in the atmosphere, and that the risks associated with nuclear energy, to whatever degree you want to say that they exist, are still less than the risks associated with global warming. And as far as that goes, I agree. The reason I don't see myself as a proponent of fission-based nuclear energy at this point is that there are better ways to go about it. It's not the best solution. It's not the cheapest solution by any means, and it's not the most efficient solution by any means, and it's not the smartest solution. And I mean smart in the smart networking kind of way. I think we are moving at quite a rapid clip into a world where our best options are going to be distributed energy. That is, rather than one, a single centralized energy plant, you have dozens or hundreds or thousands of smaller energy production points around your grid, perhaps even millions. There was actually a study done by Oxford University a couple of years ago showing that the United Kingdom could supply over 60% of its energy consumption through the use of home-based, dwelling-based solar, wind, and what's called cogeneration, where you basically the same unit does both heat and hot water. So basically, the notion of having all of your energy points distributed around the grid rather than from a single centralized plant, like a nuclear plant or a coal plant, is that it makes it much more robust so that you don't have a single point of failure. You're able to much more readily deal with the day-to-day fluctuations or the moment-by-moment fluctuations of energy demands. And if you have the right mix of energy production sources, and that's really critical here. I'm not talking about simply solar only replacing things or wind only. That's not going to happen. You're not going to have a single silver bullet solution. What you're going to have is this amazing mix of technologies that, whereas any one of them might not be sufficient or might be too intermittent, in combination, they actually provide a very robust, survivable, and stable, and more easily built system. If you can start putting out solar and wind with just a very small budget, you can't build a nuclear plant without millions upon millions of dollars.
Not to mention the nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism problems, which are
huge.
Right.
There's plenty of argument around what's the right way of doing that. I mean, there are designs for nuclear plants that would be extremely hard to turn into weapons. Unfortunately, they're not the ones that tend to be designs that produce very little waste. The ones that produce very little waste tend to produce lots of stuff that terrorists would love, or weapon makers would love, and the ones that produce very little weapons-grade material can still produce a lot of waste. It's a sad conundrum.
You've also been attracted to the idea of geoengineering. Can you just say a little bit about geoengineering approaches to actually remediating carbon in the atmosphere, how to capture carbon in the atmosphere?
Sure. I just want to make one more quick point about the energy side of things, though. And that is that as much as I'm a proponent of distributed energy and smart, soft power systems, I think the solution is going to come from radical improvements in energy use efficiency. It turns out that globally, over the last century, we have had an average of a 1% improvement in energy use efficiency, that is, the amount of work or gain or economic benefit produced by a certain amount of energy, annually. Across the whole century. At certain points, particularly in the best examples in California in the 1990s, when energy costs were very high, you actually got much greater than 1% improvements in efficiency. You actually got up to like 5 or 6% improvements. And there's a very interesting thing about improvements in efficiency. In a way, it's kind of like compound interest. If you're able to globally boost the efficiency of energy use from 1% on average per year to 2% on average per year, by the end of the century, we could support a planet of 10 billion people living at the year 2100 equivalent of European Union standard of living for less energy than we're using today. The more that we can focus on improving energy use efficiency, the less we have to worry about the construction of
So Australia's ban on incandescent bulbs and going to compact fluorescence. Do you like that idea?
Yes, exactly. Exactly, that kind of thing. And there are lots of little things that you can do to improve your energy use efficiency. You know, better insulation. A light-colored or white roof on your house. We just put a new roof on our house. We had the roof that had been here for a couple of decades was actually very dark. We replaced it with an energy-efficient light gray roof. The difference has been astounding. It is quite literally, on warm days now, a good 15 degrees cooler in the house than it was last spring.
Well, I don't have central air. We have heating, but no central air, so I'm going to keep my black roof for now. But
yes, you know, where you are, that's probably appropriate, but here in California, that's, I know for a fact that's going to make a difference of hundreds of dollars over the course of the summer just from reduction in energy cost for the use of central air.
Okay, so how do we remediate the carbon we got out there now?
So how do we remediate the carbon? Geoengineering is a really tricky subject. The concept is that all the great things you can do to reduce the carbon that you put out will help to slow and maybe even stop the increase over time, the increase in global warming. But it's not going to do anything to bring the temperature down. It's not going to do anything to bring the carbon levels down. CO2 takes over a century to cycle through the atmosphere. So just with natural processes, we're not going to get that CO2 out until the next century at the absolute earliest. So what geoengineering says is that it's possible to develop technologies that operate on a planetary scale to alter the balance of natural processes and natural substances in the atmosphere, you know, carbon in this case, so as to accelerate the process of cycling the CO2 out and to reduce, you know, over time, not just our impact, but you know, that we will do going forward, but the impact we've already had. Now, what's tricky about this is that we don't understand these processes very well yet, and it's very likely that if we were to find ourselves being so desperate to do anything to prevent climate catastrophe that we start to engage haphazardly in geoengineering efforts, we could easily find ourselves in a world where we've actually made things worse. You know, the example is that the example I like to cite here is that up until fairly recently, people used to talk about the idea of dumping large amounts of iron particles into the South Pacific in order to promote blooms of algae, because algae is really good at sucking CO2 out of the air, and it uses iron as one of its, you know, primary sources for what's energy or whatever for reproduction. It's a nutrient for algae. The problem is that it's been discovered that when you have too big of an algae bloom, and certainly something that would be big enough to start pulling CO2 out of the air in measurable levels would count as too big. You sterilize large parts of the ocean. You basically make thousands of square miles, potentially even more than that, unlivable for anything.
We discovered that because it's already happening in places.
Yes, yes, exactly. There have been, you know, various cases where you've had these massive algae blooms, you know, for natural reasons that have then turned around. You know, the result has been the deaths of fish and plants and, you know, pretty much anything. You have these completely sterilized parts of the ocean. And, you know, so one could totally imagine that had we decided 10 years ago that we desperately needed to do something to pull the CO2 out of the atmosphere, that somebody would have gone out and dumped iron into the ocean in order to promote algae. And today we would have a dead ocean, and we'd be dead not too much longer after that.
So you're open to the idea, but we have to be extremely cautious.
I'm open to the idea of, and in fact, I encourage the idea of studying it, because it is a distinct possibility. It's a distinct possibility for a couple of reasons. One, we may well get into a situation where we're utterly desperate, that no matter how hard we try to reduce the amount of carbon output that we have from our society, you know, from our civilization, it's too late. You know, and in fact, it may well be too late already, that the heat buildup that we're already committed to, you know, as I described before, would be enough to kick us over a tipping point into a new climate system, what We're currently in a warm wet system. We'd be moving into a warm dry system, which would be devastating. Would quite literally kill millions, if not billions, of people just because from starvation and pandemic disease. And so we may find ourselves desperate to do something. So since that is a very real possibility, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we know what we're doing if we face that possibility. Secondly, the idea of being able to alter geophysical systems is undoubtedly going to appeal to some national leader as a way of having of increasing their global power. Think of it as military power or geomilitary power. And so we're gonna need to study and understand how these processes work, if only because we're gonna need to know how to defend ourselves. And when I say we and ourselves, I'm not just talking about the United States. I'm talking about anyone in the world. Any nation in the world is going to need to understand what their options are. Should some rogue leader, cowboy leader, whatever you want, whoever you want to think of in that role, decide that geoengineering tools would be a really great way of forcing another state to do something it otherwise didn't want to do.
Well, that's a happy thought to end on, but we're going to have you back because you have a lot of interesting thoughts about our cyber future as well. You've written these participatory panopticon articles, and you're involved in meta universe mapping and all kinds of things. So we'll have you back on soon. We've been speaking with Jamay Cassio. He's a futurist. You can find more of his work at the IET website and also at openthefuture.com. He's the co-founder of worldchanging.com, which has a wonderful new book out, which includes some of his work, and the author of the novels Broken Dreams and Toxic Memes. Well, thank you for being with us today, Jamay.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.